Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 36, Appalachian Weaving. This episode, we're chatting with Pam Howard, the resident weaver at the John C. Campbell Folk School. This is in Brasstown, North Carolina, and the John C. Campbell Folk School has been around since 1926. So we're going to be talking about historical Appalachian weaving, as well as what is currently going on with weaving in that area. We've got a lot of weaving news this episode. I don't know if this is because there is more going on in the weaving world than ever, or if because people are just telling me more often. But in either case, I have lots of wonderful things to share with you. First of all, there is the Tree Project. My friend Jenny tipped me onto this one. It's a project to create this large collaborative art installation. And what they're doing is they're asking people to send leaves that have been made using some variety of fiber arts. It could be felting, it could be knitting. I checked with the coordinators, and yes, they're very happy to accept hand-woven leaves. What they're going to do is they're going to take up to 30,000 of these leaves and create a ginormous tree. And the goal of it is to illustrate how communities are interrelated through this big art installation. So if you'd like to be a part of that, check out the show notes. There will be a link to the International Fiber Collaborative. People who saw the CBS early show about glass weaving have been chatting about it on the online groups. My friend Kate tipped me off, and you can see artists Tom Norris and Eric Markow at work in their studio creating these wonderfully woven glass vessels using pulled glass stringers. In the video, they're kind of cagey about their methods, so they don't actually show you a step-by-step. But somebody came to the CBS video site and posted a link to the Pittsburgh Glass Center. And if you're in the Pittsburgh area, and this is something you're interested in learning, they actually teach classes on weaving with glass. So links to both of those will be in the show notes. In other news, I have created a Twitter account for WeaveZine. Twitter is what's called a microblogging platform. You get 140 characters per post, so it's not like a traditional blog where you have big pictures and you have lots of text. It's just like these little bursts of information. I think of them as kind of blog haikus. All the cool kids were doing it. Yarn Harlot's online, Webs is online, Nitty is online. And so now, yes, WeaveZine is also online. It's this fun stream of consciousness. If you want to know what I'm doing at any given time during the day, it's your best option. You can go check that out at www.twitter.com/WeaveZine. And as always, there will be a link on the show notes. In other WeaveZine-related web goodness, there is a group called Startup Nation, and they are running a competition called Moms in Business. And the way this works is any mom-owned business can be entered in this contest. People go up and read their profiles, learn more about the company, and then vote on them. And the top entrepreneurs? The top women in business who also have children will be part of this huge publicity blitz. And they're talking about having people on national and local television, on radio stations, and all over the web. So it's a really cool thing. And WeaveZine is up there, but there are also some other wonderful businesses. And it's very inspirational to just go and read what all these wonderful, creative, inventive women are doing. One of my favorites, and one that I voted for, was Bella Bandanas. Just a wonderful story. So if you're interested in that, there will be a link on the show notes to the Startup Nation Women in Business competition. There is a festival happening in September in Oakville, Ontario, Canada. It's called the Worlds of Threads Festival. It's got all kinds of fiber artists, and if you want to learn more about that, you can go check it out on the web at worldofthreadsfestival.com. Again, link, show notes. You're sensing a theme here. And then last, but certainly not least in our weaving news blitz, is a new blog called weftywoman.com. The author writes this in the announcement letter. I would like to invite you to check out my new site, Wefty Woman. I'm going for a little more shock value with this site, and I would like to get more young people excited about weaving. Well, hear, hear. If you'd like to check that out, weftywoman.com, show notes, you know what to do. Our sponsor this episode is One-to-One, Women Coaching Women. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to assisting women to achieve sustained success in creating the life of their dreams through one-to-one coaching. And this is a bit of a departure from our normal sponsorships, which are weaving-related businesses. But when Susie approached me about running this sponsorship, I said yes, because coaching has been such an important part of my life. I work with a business coach, and that is what gave me the gumption to launch WeaveZine last year. No matter what your dreams are, if they're just to be happier at home, to finally get that really complicated double weave warp put on your loom, or if it's to launch a weaving business, their website is www.onetoone.info. The Ensemble folks, which is a group of about 12 individuals, have been working really hard learning new tools and editing audio. There are several people who are really close to getting me finished audio, and I am so excited about that. Because the ironic thing is, of all the people in the world, the one person who doesn't get a weaving podcast right now is me. By the time I finish doing all the work and editing, I am so sick of listening to the audio, especially my own voice, that I never listen to them again. So having the Ensemble folks working on these interviews that have been taped months ago and I forgot what is in them kind of gives me an insight into why people like Weavecast. I'm like, I can't wait. I want to hear it. So a big thank you to all the Ensemble folks working hard. Some people were lucky and they got these short interviews, and some people got the hour and a half long interviews that they're going to have to cut way down. But regardless of whether you had a challenge or a cakewalk, I really appreciate that so many people have stepped up to the plate and are helping out. Soon, we should be getting more audio edited and be able to do these a little bit faster. Just to prove that we're all just human, I have a correction from last episode. I talked about a new fiber guild that was starting up in Alabama, and I indicated that it was in Birmingham, and it's not. It's in Selma, Alabama. I had just come back from a week in Birmingham visiting relatives, and I had been all over Birmingham. I'd gone up and seen the big Vulcan statue on top of the mountain, and I'd gone to the Galleria, and I had Birmingham on the brain. And so, mea culpa, my bad. The New Fiber Guild is in Selma. Birmingham, Alabama already has a wonderful, thriving fiber guild. It's multi-fiber, but it's very welcoming to weavers. Actually, Laura Fry is teaching there. It's called the Greater Birmingham Fiber Guild, and there is a link to that in the show notes. They say they have weavers, spinners, tatters, bobbin lacers, knitters, crocheters, and dyers. That's a lot of fiber. I bet they let felters in the room, too. And so Birmingham, y'all, just to show that I'm sorry about my mistake, this upcoming song is for you.
Long time to the other side.
That was Birmingham by Beth Thornley. Beth Thornley has graced Weavecast before with her wonderful song Double Wide, and she is fast becoming one of my favorite indie singer-songwriters. And I just want to drop a little note. It's been a while since I talked about this. All the music that you hear on Weavecast, well, almost all the music, comes from the Podsafe Music Network. And how this works is musicians put their songs up on the Podsafe Music Network for free, and allow podcasters like me to download them and use them for free in the hopes that somewhere along the line, somebody will hear their song and become enraptured with that musician's work and then go out and buy the CD. And this is how the musician gets support and is able to continue making the music. So Beth Thornley is somebody that I like so much that I went out and bought her CD. And if you hear at some point on the show an artist whose work really strikes you, do click that link in the show notes and see if they have a CD for sale. Because, you know, if you like one song of theirs, you're probably going to like some of their other songs. And there may be good stuff out there that's not necessarily weaving related that you're missing out on. Coming up, we have Pam Howard. She is currently the resident weaver for the John C. Campbell Folk School, just a wonderful multi-craft school in Brasstown, North Carolina. She has done illustrations for Shuttle Spindle and Dye Pot. She's been involved with HGA's distance learning program, and she has won awards for her weaving. The John C. Campbell Folk School is a school that teaches a wide variety of arts and crafts. It is based on the Danish Model Folk School. And if you're wondering what the heck a Danish Model Folk School is, stay tuned. We will explain it all coming up. If you listened to episode 20 of Weavecast, you heard me talk about the course I took last year on Scottish weaving. And it was just a wonderful time. Part of the interview that you're hearing today was recorded back then, and part was in a more recent telephone conversation. So I have interleaved these two interviews to provide you audio goodness. The downside of this is that you'll be able to hear the difference between, you know, the rich, smooth, wonderful sound of an in-person interview and the somewhat grainy sound of audio that has traveled over telephone lines. So if Pam Howard sounds a little bit different from clip to clip, that's what's going on. The first question I asked Pam is my perennial, how'd you get started weaving? And I know I ask everybody this question, but I always get a really interesting story.
My mother was a home economics teacher. I was in the seventh grade and somebody had donated an old barn loom to her department. Came in, I was in the same school that she was teaching, and I walked in, and here was this pile of sticks, and I knew right off what it was. And I started on her, and I'm like, oh, you're going to set it up, aren't you? And she's like, no. And I'm like, well, why not? This is a loom. Here's a loom. She said, no. I tried working on her for probably a month. And finally, one day I came in and it was gone. And I said, where's the loom? And she says, well, we couldn't use it here in the school. It's just too old. And we had them take it to the dump. Well, I was mad. Now, that was probably getting towards the end of the summer. For Christmas, my mother bought me a rigid heddle loom because I pouted for a long time. So I wove on that rigid heddle loom all through high school, and my mom would help me. Back then, it was Aunt Lydia's yarn. And you could go and you could get 3 skeins of cotton, Aunt Lydia.
That's the crochet yarn?
Well, yeah, but, you know, that's what I had at my five and dime. I didn't have the resources, the car, the idea of where to go and find a guild or anything like that. I still have that rigid heddle loom to this day. I went to college and then I moved to Georgia, married my husband. He happened to be a blacksmith. We would go to a place called the Tully Smith House with the Atlanta History Center. The Tully Smith House was an old house, Civil War era, and of course they had a barn loom in there. So when I walked in there, I saw the barn loom and I went, oh, that's like the barn loom at school. There was a lady there. She says, well, you just come right down here and sit down and start weaving. And so my husband was out at the blacksmith shop and they were working. And when he would come to meetings, I would go in the house and I would sit and weave. Now, I didn't really learn a lot of the threading and stuff because usually it was already threaded up. But this lady who sat me down there, her name is Betty Smith. Betty realized I had a love for this. And so she kept trying to get me to, come on, let's start weaving. And she had a shop in her basement. And I kept holding off because I was a newlywed, no money and all that. And finally an opportunity came along for me to illustrate a needleworking book. And I got paid $1,000. And my dear sweet husband says, that money's yours. That doesn't have to go in the household account. You buy what you want. And I bought my first loom.
Great story. What advice would you give beginning weavers?
I want people to have fun and to realize that even though you have a lot of strings and you have equipment, you can make beautiful cloth and still be creative and have fun. And that's my thing, is relax and have a good time. I try to make it pretty easy and comfortable for people because they can get really uptight about it. And it's, you know, if I can do it, other people can do it.
What do you know now about weaving that you wish you'd known back when you were a beginner?
Well, this is one of the first things I tell my weaving students. The Green Marguerite Davison book. That book is made for a counterbalance loom. So you don't read the X's, you read the blank spaces.
You have a lot of upside down.
Well, yeah, you know, where the heck is my pattern? And then you find it. That's one of the things that I tell beginning students is watch out for that.
You showed me some of your tablet weaving, and one of them was this really amazing, wider than I'd expect piece. It was about, 6 inches wide of a gecko?
Well, not quite 6.
Okay.
It's about 4.
4 inches wide.
It's what's called double woven tablet weaving. You have to really use your brain on it. I set it up on somewhat of a homemade loom. It's not like on a floor loom like what we think, because you're using the tablet or cardboard cards with 4 holes in them. And what I had to do was I had to graft out my pictures. And then I actually did samples on this. Then I set up the cards, and I can't remember how many cards I had in it. Some of the tablets were going one way. Some were going back towards me. Things were moving in all kinds of different ways. To me, it's such a neat way of doing something so intricate on very inexpensive equipment. And the equipment is basically your cards or your tablets. We call them both. I set it up so that they were attached to a way that I could advance the warp. And then they went up and the ends of the warp were weighted. so as I was weaving, the twist of the yarn was going up and out the end of the warp. And so I was able to do a longer piece without having to worry about a twist building up.
That's ingenious. Twist is one of the limitations card weavers work against.
Well, they do, and it depends upon the piece of equipment they have. Actually, I've got a band that I found in an antique store, and when I thought I was jumping up and down for joy, it is a natural dyed wool piece that you can tell somebody was working on one end and somebody else was weaving on the other end, and they met in the middle.
Wait a second, you've just blown my mind. How can you tell that that's what happened?
It's the way the pattern is. What they would do is one would work twisting one way and the other one would twist the other way, and so it would zero out the twist.
That's ingenious. That's like a duet almost.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. And I think it was probably a camel strap or something. I'm not sure what it was. But I knew that it was tablet weaving, and I was very excited to find that piece. There's all kinds of different ways of achieving. It's not really weaving. It's kind of a twining technique. You've got a weft thread that goes through this shed where the cards have been twisted and turned. So it's a substantial band. It's kind of a heavy-duty band. Depending upon the size of your yarn you use, you can do some beautiful patterns. There's lots of people out there who are doing this. There's actually a wonderful little site on the internet called Tablet Weavers International Study and Techniques, which is TWIST. People who are interested in tablet weaving can go to that site and get more information.
When I saw the gecko weaving that we were talking about, it looked very much like a jacquard weaving. Do you ever consider that the cards are in some way like programming a jacquard loom because you're controlling the threads by threads?
It's the placement of the color of the yarn to the placement of how it turns, so that when you turn that pack of cards and tablets, certain colors come up. So when I did this, I started out with really big fat threads. I mean, almost like what you would use, oh gosh, for big rag rugs. So I made this giant gecko, and I had put it out on graph paper. What I realized when doing this, it elongates, so I had this really long lizard. And so I had to adjust that. So when I did it with the 5/2 pearl cotton, it was more proportionate to what I was wanting. And the whole thing was, when I built my studio, there were these funny little geckos that were all over the trees. And it was like, oh, you know how in the South you have to name your plantation or your farm? And so I named it Lizardville. That's how that piece came along, was because if you remember, there was a little cabin and then a tree. And it was the little cabin in the woods where the lizards live. And that was the name of the piece.
Very cool. The John C. Campbell Folk School is a really amazing and unique place. And even more interesting than just the facility itself is the story of how it came to be. In the 1920s, two women established the Folk School. Kind of an unusual thing back then when women weren't always community leaders. Can you tell me a little bit about the people who founded the Folk School?
They call it the John C. Campbell Folk School. John Campbell, bless his heart, died before he ever got to see the Folk School take hold. And his wife, Olive Campbell, and Marguerite Butler, they were friends. And Olive continued John's dream. They went to Denmark and studied folk schools over in Denmark. Those folk schools were very successful over there, and they came back over here, and they toured the Appalachian region. They came to little old Brasstown, North Carolina. Olive Campbell went around and talked to several people and said, are you all interested in having some sort of school that would be community-minded, that would help the economy in this area? And so she told them, well, come back and meet me on this day if y'all are interested. When she came back, she was so pleased to see that there were quite a number of people who were like, yes, we are very, very interested in this. So it took several years from 1925, I believe, to 1928 before the first class happened. But people donated land, people donated time. It was a real community effort, and they started building buildings.
Weren't the buildings largely put up by volunteers?
Oh, absolutely, yes. If you go into the History Center, you can see the pledge cards up on the wall that somebody would donate a dollar a month or would donate a load of lumber, things like that, to help build the school. It started off small, and today, this campus, we have about 360 acres. I don't know how many buildings, and some of them are still the old beautiful rock walled buildings that were built in the 20s and 30s. It's a very, very nice campus to park your car for a week and just walk.
It's wonderful to see the old buildings. And what's interesting to me was the culture of the John C. Campbell Folk School, because that sense of coming together to make something really special that it originated with seems to still be there.
Yeah, it's a non-competitive atmosphere, and they really strive to keep that. Nobody gets grades. It's where you feel like you can learn, and it's not about so much the product as the process. The good thing is most people make just absolutely beautiful, wonderful things, and they've had a great time in doing it. It's relaxing. They always say it's just good folks. I mean, it's a good time with a lot of good people.
Do you have a lot of return students?
Yes. Lots of return students. I can be walking along the campus or I go in the office and I hear, hey, Pam, and it could be a student that I taught 3 or 4 years ago. And it's like, oh, you're back. We have a lady who has been coming, I think a couple of years ago, we had a big party or reception because she had taken 100 classes.
Wow.
And truthfully, I thought she lived in Brasstown because she was there all the time. And I'm like, well, Alice, where do you live? And she says, oh, Atlanta. And I'm like, oh, well, cool. So we do have a lot of people that come. And we have families that come up and have family reunions. And they want to come up and they all take different classes. We have housing on campus. It's a lot of fun. We have this big, beautiful dining hall and the food is fabulous. You can park your car and walk the entire week and just be immersed in what you're doing. And I used to tell my students that, you know, you can come here and you don't have to make your bed. You can just get out of bed and come to class and stay as late as you want and have a really good time and know that you've really accomplished something and you've learned something and it's a special time.
I love the family dining hall and the idea of not having to cook for a week.
Yeah.
It made that walking around campus really necessary.
Really important. Well, now let me tell you something. People, they go and they say, well, there's just way too many desserts. Well, you don't have to eat them.
Oh, they're so tempting. Yes, you get dessert lunch and dinner.
Lunch and dinner, yeah. Think about the students who take the cooking classes. They really get to eat. There's all kinds of different classes. If somebody can't find a class that they're interested in, I don't know. There's classes that I would still like to take. I'm married to a blacksmith, but I've never taken a blacksmithing course. I guess I should one of these days.
What is a Danish model folk school?
The folk schools over in Denmark now are totally different. Actually, I went to the folk school that Olive and Marguerite visited. I mean, I didn't go there as a student, but had lunch there. They call them high schools, and it's where students go before they go to college. Their whole school system is different from the way we have ours here. If somebody wants to go and they want to do music and dance, they go to this folk high school, and that's all they do is learn music and dance. Or if they want to learn about weaving, that's what they do. It's almost like on-the-job training. I mean, it's real intense. It was sort of a community thing. They all came in and ate together, dorm situations, the whole thing. If you look at the buildings at the folk school and you look at Keith House And then I looked at the buildings at the folk school in Denmark. The lines are the same. It's really cool. I'm just one of a long line of resident artists who have been at the folk school. And basically, my job is to maintain the studio and hire the instructors. I also teach. I'm really good at repairing looms. Things like that that keep that weaving studio going. I'm a bit prejudiced, but I think we've got a pretty doggone good studio. We have lots of different looms. Judy Malloy was the resident artist before me. She gave it up, and I've had it for about 8 years. Before I became resident artist, I taught at the folk school, and then when I moved to Brasstown, I thought I was just going to be a full-time weaver and weave away, and they offered the job to me, and it's great. It's a wonderful way to get to talk to a lot of neat people, and I love teaching. It's a great program. I probably schedule 50-something weaving classes a year.
How do you choose which instructors to bring in and what kind of classes to offer?
I'm given a certain number of classes that I have to schedule, and I divide it up into what I call fabric weaving, which is rug weaving or rug hooking, and I also have thread art, and that could be tatting or some sort of needle art, things like that. I schedule quite a few classes. I get my hand-woven magazine, I get Bob magazine, I try to observe on the internet to see what everybody's talking about, to know what is current in the weaving world. And then it's my call. I try to get a variety of informative classes that people will go, oh, wow, I would really like to take from them. And I've got a lot of people who've been teaching there for years, and then I have a lot of new people, and I rotate everybody around. It's a challenge because everybody wants to teach at the folk school, and unfortunately, I can't have everybody, but I try to share the wealth.
It's not a full-time job, so it allows me to do my other things that I need to do.
You also co-own a yarn store?
I do. It's called Yarn Circle. I'm in partnership with Martha Owen, who is the resident spinner and knitter at the folk school. We're kind of the fiber department. We were really wanting to be able to have high-quality yarns and equipment and things that the students at the folk school, when they come and take a class, they're able to continue that instead of trying to find it, you know, in their local store or on the internet or something like that. And because we've taught them, or other teachers who we know have taught them, we kind of have a good idea of what is theirs. So Martha and I kind of said, well, okay, we'll try it. And we've been open for about 2.5 years. And the folk school has been so kind and so supportive of us. So it's been really nice.
The Appalachian region runs along the Appalachian Mountain Range in the southeast part of the United States. In fact, the Appalachian Mountains run all the way to the northeast part of the United States. And it's got its own distinctive culture. It's been strongly influenced by the Scottish immigrants who settled there. So I asked Pam, what are some of the characteristics of Appalachian weaving?
I don't know if there's a distinction. I know that with my affiliation with the John Campbell Folk School, there was a resurgence of trying to get people to be a little more self-sufficient. So around the turn of the century and into the early teens, there were people that were coming into the Southern Appalachian Mountains that were trying to get the people going on making a living. So there was wood carving, there was all kinds of stuff. And one of them was weaving. I think what was so distinctive about it was the old coverlets. These were pieces that were done on old four-harness looms that were back up in what we would call the holler.
And are these the overshot coverlets?
Right, the overshot coverlets. I know that there were several schools and several people who sought after these weavers to get them to help make more items, and then they would sell them up north. What I would consider an Appalachian style weaving would be the coverlets, the really simple things that people could have done on a four-harness loom that were just, I mean, they're, to me, they're just absolutely beautiful.
And what about today? Are there trends going on in the Southeast, like up here in the Pacific Northwest? We have a lot of painted warps. A couple of years ago, we went through a real rayon chenille craze. How would you characterize weaving in North Carolina, South Carolina?
We have the painted warps and we have the chenille weaving and the network drafting and things like that. Southerners are always influenced by what's in the magazines and what's on the internet and things like that. But we also still have overshot weaving and the simpler weaves that were the what I consider the historical things. And there's still people out there who teach that information, and it's great. And so I guess I'd have to say that the Southern weavers did your overshots and your summer and winter, Lindsay Woolsey, things like that. And the Northeast, there was all the mills that were coming in because of all the water mills and things like that that powered the loom. I think the history is a lot older. And then by the time that things got out towards the West Coast, more commercial stuff was going on. So you may not have that. Although you've got the history of the Navajo weavings and things like that. I think it's just whatever the area has. It stayed in that area just because of lack of communication. We didn't have the World Wide Web back then. Now we do, and so you get a lot more education.
It'd be interesting to look historically at what weave structures were popular where and see how the magazines and the internet influenced that as weavers were more able to share ideas. Pam Howard is working on a project with Judy Malloy to preserve and document some historic weaving drafts, and I asked her to tell me a little bit more about this project.
The thing that my friend Judy Malloy and I are working on, we found some old coverlet drafts. We're having to go back and think, how did these people weave these pieces during that time with the equipment they had? We're working on it, but we have to think like those people did back in 1848. It's a challenge.
Where did you find these weaving drafts that you're studying?
We found some old drafts in the History Center at the John Campbell Folk School. We had decided to take these drafts and decipher them and then put them in a computer program, then go and actually weave the samples and then have it as a exhibit at the History Center at the Folk School. We enlisted our good friend and mentor, Barbara Miller, who is an expert on coverlet weaving and Appalachian weaving. We have decided to work on this, but we've had to determine what kind of loom did they use, how they threaded it, you know, front to back, back to front, which side did they start on, how was the tie-up done, how was the treadling done, because all we have are small little strips of paper. Some of the papers have been sewn together. This project may take a while, but we would really like to get it going and then eventually maybe put it in some sort of booklet, raise money for the Fiber Library or the Folk School or something like that. It's just a fun project to dive into history and see how it went.
When you're working with extrapolation based on scanty historical weave structure evidence, how do you know when you've got it right?
We call it Barbara and go, Barbara! There's a certain way with overshot based on a twill, and then there's a thing called Trompas Rit. And it was usually on a 2-2 twill. And thank goodness we have computer programs these days that we can input that information in and then look at it and go, this doesn't look right. And some of these little pieces of paper have got stains on them and numbers crossed out and things like that. So we have to kind of determine, well, is that a dot or is that a spot? When it doesn't quite look right, then we go, oh, it must have been a spot. It's kind of a bit of a guessing game, but Barbara has seen so many overshot patterns that she can look at it and say, oh, okay, I think I know what this is, and she's usually right.
This leads into my next question. You and Judy Malloy both were or are resident weavers at the John C. Campbell Folk School, so it makes a lot of sense that you'd explore that. What is the history of weaving at the Folk School?
The Folk School started in 1925. They started bringing in different types of programs, wood carving, blacksmithing, things like that, and weaving was part of it. It kind of goes along with these other schools that are in the Southeast that was this revival of hand weaving and trying to get the community people involved in making some sort of living in the Appalachian area. Over the years, weaving has been a very important part of the Folk School.
The Folk School is this kind of magical place. It's hard to describe if you haven't been there. So I asked Pam what she thought made the Folk School so great.
It's the folk. People get connected here. People meet people. I've got friends who I have met that I've come here and I keep in touch with them, and it's like a big reunion. There's people that have family reunions here, that the mom, the daughter, the sons, the daughter-in-law, they come and take classes here. It's a school where it's not production-oriented, it's not product-oriented, it's let's learn how we can make this and take it home and do it. And it's try not to have a whole lot of pressure, but it's a whole lot of fun. It's not just about weaving, although I'm proud to say I think we have a pretty doggone good weaving program. It's about sitting at the table and somebody going, wow, that looks pretty cool to be in the blacksmithing class. Maybe I'd like to try that. And it's a way for people to kind of get to doing things that they may not have thought about doing, but could try it and really have a good time. You know, all the programs are fabulous here.
And of course, I wanted to know her plans for the future.
I think continue with what I'm doing, working here at the Folk School and teaching. I love that. I'm not doing as much production work as I did. I'm trying to do more individual pieces that I could enter in a show, and working on the store and keeping it going and keeping happy and making new weavers.
Yeah.
Today's audio essay is Do-Overs. As much as it is wonderful when a project just goes perfectly from the start to the end, or when in the middle of a project, you figure out that one little threading change, set change, treadling change that makes it perfect, sometimes you just have to look at that project, throw your hands up in the air, and say, do-over. One of my do-overs right now is heartbreaking. It's not weaving, it's knitting. And knitting, thank goodness, makes do-overs easy. You don't even lose much of the yarn. So I have this wonderful sideways knit cardigan in Noro Silk Garden. Yes, it was a big investment. It was a large chunk of yarn budget. And because it's knit sideways, the stripes are going vertically, and it's just lovely. And the colors are perfect, and they're discontinued because it's a sweater I've been working on for quite some time. And I was so proud of it when I was knitting it because it was one of my first garments I was knitting, and it was my very first cardigan, and I had just learned about short rows for socks, and I was like, oh, I can, you know, increase the bust area with short rows, and so the buttons won't gap in front. And I worked out all the math, and I put it together, and it fit beautifully. And I'm looking at it now, and I'm realizing that it fit beautifully when I was nursing my son. And now that he's been weaned for several years, it no longer fits. All those short rows are working against me. Alas. So, I had a choice. I could leave the sweater on the dressmaker's dummy and admire it from across the room, or I can unravel it and have a do-over. I'm having me a do-over. Oh, I had to think about that one. It's a beautiful sweater. I want to wear it. I finally found the perfect buttons to go with it. This sweater is getting done again. Another area where I am experiencing a need for a do-over is on my new loom. Before Christmas, I warped up a 2-inch sectional section with some 140/2 silk that I was planning to make bookmarks with. And the bookmarks didn't happen. I'm sorry. They're going to be next year's Christmas present. I'm starting in July. Me and my friends who make Christmas presents all vowed New Year's Day that next year we would start our Christmas presents in July. So if in the July podcast I am not talking about making Christmas presents, feel free to leave a comment and tell me to get started. But anyway, so I put 9 yards of a 2-inch wide bookmark warp on the loom, and I am just not feeling the bookmark love right now. The thought of weaving 9 yards of superfine silk for bookmarks is just not appealing. And so I'm either going to take that section off, or I'm going to add more sectional warp sections and make a wide piece of superfine cloth. Because that is the beauty of weaving. Once you get warped, it's just as fast to weave a 3-foot wide section. So I'm thinking about that. I'm also not sure what I want to weave. I mean, do I want to weave a fancy twill? Do I want to play around with summer and winter, which could be fun? I've never played around with summer and winter. The other part of the do-over is also elsewhere on that sectional beam. I have a section that I started winding for another warp. Does anybody else do this? Am I the only person who puts like sections on their warp beam and doesn't really have a project in mind and just kind of like figures things out as they go? Probably, huh? Anyway, I'm going to take that section off and save it for later because the good news is I can totally have a do-over. I now have 2 inches worth of warp that I can put on the loom later. So check back next podcast and I'll give an update of what I actually ended up weaving, whether it was 140/2 silk, whether it was 6/2 cotton, or something else entirely. And the final do-over I'm actually really excited about. 3 years ago this February, I started Weavecast. And at the time, Weavecast was a lark. and an experiment, and I had no idea I would still be doing WeaveCast 3 years later. And I had no idea that I would at some point do an online weaving magazine, WeaveZine. And I had no idea that I would be doing a weaving blog, WeaveGeek. And so what I've discovered is I now have three separate audiences on three separate websites that all use different technologies. And it is confusing and hard to maintain. I'm using Blogger for WeaveCast, I'm using WordPress for WeaveGeek, and I'm using hand-coded HTML pages for the WeaveZine site. So it is time for a do-over. And the cool thing is, there's a lot of functionality that I want to add. And so I'm going to pull all of these three sites together into one Uber site. Now, no fears, WeaveCast will still be easy to access. It'll still be in iTunes, but we're going to have some new cool features, such as the ability to stream audio directly from the WeaveZine site. It's something people have been asking about for a long time. And I've got a test site up that I'm secretly playing around with, and it's working, and it's so cool. And there will be search, and there will be up-to-date archives. One of the troubles with the current WeaveZine site is all the archives are hand-coded, which means I only update them when I've got a chance, and sometimes they get behind. But on the new site, the archives are created programmatically, so they will always be up-to-date. And the transcripts will be easy to find, and it's just going to be wonderful. So look for that in March. It's currently under development and testing. So I'm having do-overs in my knitting, in my weaving, and in my web development. And the cool thing is, when you have a do-over, I mean, it's disheartening to have to start again and do something you thought was done. But when you have a do-over, you have gained experience and you have a much better idea of how you want to go forward than before you started. So even if you don't know exactly what you want to do, like me throwing things up on my warp beam, I'm still farther along than if I didn't have anything up there already. Do-overs, a chance to get it right. That's all for this episode. So until next time, it's time to get warped. Because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. WeaveCast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Mary, Linda J., Linda M., and Prue in Australia, Barb and the Mountain Spinners and Weavers Guild, Marie, Dawn, Terrell, Sue, and Allison. I'm currently saving up to buy some loaner audio gear to hand out to the ensemble folks for when they have interview opportunities, and I appreciate all the help. Our sponsor this episode is One-to-One Women Coaching Women, a nonprofit organization that helps women create the life of their dreams through one-to-one life coaching. Our musical guests this episode were Beth Thornley with her song Birmingham and the Divine Maggies with North Carolina. I'd like to thank all of these artists for sharing their work on the PodSafe Music Network. You can find out more about them and their music by clicking the links in the show notes.
Oh, I'm supposed to talk.
Yeah,
so
yeah, well, that's the whole thing. Well,
okay.
You don't have to say
so anything. She didn't get a mic, or are you just going to ask me questions first?
This
you
is called first. Sound check.
Sound check. Okay.
This will not be in the show.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
My mother-in-law wears army shoes.
That might be. Don't tempt me.